It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Janice Dean.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Martha McCallum, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, June 10th, 2022. I'm Chris Foster. The man who admits planning to attack Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh at his home in Maryland says he was motivated in part by the fight for abortion rights.
When you get something as controversial as what the Supreme Court is going through right now, it really does not only uptick the security package you want to bring, but also I'm sure it increases the amount of intelligence that they're getting.
I'm Lisa Brady. In a crowded field for U.S. Senate, one Republican hopeful says he'll represent the Constitution and Nevadans, not big donors or big names.
I answer to the people, and I think when we have more folks like that sitting in the halls of Congress, we'll get more done on an expedited manner.
And I'm Jason Chaffetz. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Fight for more gun control and abortion rights, he says, is what sent a 26-year-old man from California to Maryland to attack Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Instead, Nicholas Roski called 911 and turned himself in. He's charged with attempted murder, armed with a gun, knife, and tools that could help him break into a house and kidnap someone. There have been pro-choice protests outside some justices' homes. Top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell.
Far-left activists publicize justices' private addresses and encourage angry people to flock to their homes.
We understand that there are people who are vulnerable to that kind of rhetoric on both the right and the left.
Illinois Senate Democrat Dick Durbin. Justice Kavanaugh's address isn't hard to find on the internet.
Well, the biggest challenge is that it is a publicly known address. And just like this young man did with Justice Kavanaugh's home, he was easily able to find out the address.
Jeff James, a retired Secret Service agent.
You also deal with, although there are certain neighbors that like having a lot of security in their area, you do deal with creating a security headache for some neighbors. But for the most part, the largest problem you're going to have is that people can just easily get online and find out where that person they're looking for is located.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine you want to have something. Well, how do you balance having a presence that's unobtrusive, but also a presence that may be a deterrent?
First of all, you look at the intelligence and you determine your manpower from there. If you can do it with two-man teams, one in front and one in back, that are very inobtrusive, they can stay in a car like it looks like the marshals were at Justice Kavanaugh's residence when this incident happened, then that's fine. But if you start to gather a lot of intelligence that this person you're protecting is a target, to be honest, convenience goes out the window and inobtrusiveness goes out the window.
Yeah. Now, this guy was apparently upset about the shooting in Texas and ending abortion rights potentially. Stuff like that leaked abortion opinion, does that put protective agencies on high alert? Is there like, oh, okay, something can blow up here because of this?
Yeah, well, we know that there are eight, in studies that the Secret Service did, there are eight reasons that people choose to launch an attack on a prominent figure. You know, we're putting aside with this young man the idea of getting notoriety and fame. But, you know, they are things like, you know, to avenge a perceived wrong, to feel like they're fixing a problem, and to bring about political change is one as well. So, yeah, that is when you get something as controversial as what the Supreme Court is going through right now, it really does not only uptick the security package you want to bring, but also I'm sure it increases the amount of intelligence that they're getting as far as the emails and letters that the justices are receiving.
This guy, he apparently, you know, confessed, and he was obviously physically there. But people like Supreme Court justices and anybody who's moderately famous get threats all the time. How do you determine it? This is separate from this specific case with Kavanaugh, but how do you determine what's a credible threat?
Well, in the Secret Service, we took every one of them seriously. And if it turned out that it was some drunk guy in a bar who had just lost his job and he was shooting his mouth off about the economy and said, you know, this is Biden's fault, I'm going to go get him. We took that every bit as seriously as if we found a manifesto online where someone said they were gathering weapons and developing a plan to come to Washington and kill the president. So I think you don't try to differentiate them. You run them all to the ground, and it's manpower intensive, and it takes time, but there needs to be a sense of urgency with it. And there needs to be a true level of seriousness, because in a lot of ways, unless you can take the time to do a true threat assessment, you don't know the difference between someone who's just making a threat and someone who truly poses a threat.
Yeah. How do you, you mentioned manpower? There must be, Lord knows how many threats there are made against the president, whoever the president is, pretty much every day of the week. Not that they all get to Secret Service ears or U.S. Marshals ears, but how is it possible to run all this stuff down in a timely manner?
Well, I would tell you, when I left the Secret Service several years ago, we were averaging 5 death threats a day just toward the president. Then you add in the vice president, their families, foreign heads of state who would come to the United States, who got protection. And then former presidents, like we just saw the plot recently with President Bush. We were fortunate in the Secret Service that we had at the time about 3,000 agents that could chase things all over the United States. From what I understand, the Supreme Court Police only has, if I remember the number correctly, about 190 officers. So they would partner with their law enforcement partners pretty much anywhere in the country. If the threat came from, say, Pittsburgh, they could contact the police there in Pittsburgh and get intelligence on the person who made the threat, and then get their help about saying, hey, is there a chance you could check on this person, see if they're gathering weapons, get some information for us. And then at that point, if it was deemed credible, they could partner with the federal partners like the FBI to step in and help take the person into custody or issue warrants and things like that.
You mentioned the Supreme Court Police Department, which I didn't know existed until recently. They're in charge of protecting justices and I assume other Supreme Court employees or just the justices inside D.C. and outside D.C. It falls to the U.S. Marshals. Justice Kavanaugh lives in Maryland, so that's why the marshals were there. What does the Supreme Court Police Department do? You mentioned 190.
Well, they're first and foremost, they secure the Supreme Court itself. They secure the building. But they are just like any other law enforcement agency you would find. They have a canine division and an intelligence division. They have an HR department. So while their primary responsibility is protecting the building, when the justices are in, they have a plan to, if something would happen, they would relocate the justices to a safe place. They have all their security and relocation protocols in place. So while the building is, even when it's empty, is their primary responsibility, when the justices are in their offices or in holding court, the justices and the safety of the justices are primary to them.
Since the Kavanaugh case, since this abortion leak, there have been protests outside the homes of some of those justices. How do you balance free speech as a security professional? How do you balance free speech and protest rights with protection? I mean, is it legal to keep a perimeter around a protectee's home, for example?
Well, the first thing I tell people all the time is there are limits to the First Amendment. So, everybody goes back to the old example of yelling fire in a theater. But you also don't have the right to be civilly disobedient, and you don't have the right to break the law. So private property is still private property. You know, there are certain things you can't say, even something very simple as if you're in a fight with another citizen, you can't say, I'm going to find you and kill you. So what you have to do is follow the law. You grant people their ability to protest if they're doing it lawfully, if they have permits, et cetera. But people need to realize that the First Amendment isn't a catch-all for anything you want to say or anything you want to do because you disagree with a certain stance. So my biggest piece of advice to law enforcement to keep from getting themselves into trouble and overstepping and possibly breaching someone's rights is know the law where you're working, know what people are allowed and not allowed to do. And if they're breaking the law, being civilly disobedient or saying things outside of what's allowed by the First Amendment, then you're allowed to take action.
Nicholas Roski, this guy who came from California to Maryland to, apparently at least threaten, if not hunt down Justice Kavanaugh, he called 911 on himself and backed out over whatever plan he had. So the marshals didn't really have a chance for heroics there. I don't know what would have happened if he had just wandered around the neighborhood so close to the property. But does a guy like that, he's in his mid-20s, from what you know about his actions, does he fit a type that you would have come across?
Well, we know schizophrenia and psychoses manifest themselves in a large majority of the time late in someone's teens, if they're going to suffer with that mental illness, and it is sad. So he seems age appropriate, but also that obsession you know, think about what would you travel all the way across the country for? It has to be something incredibly important to you, right? So, you know, for him to fit the idea of this is something he was so obsessed with that he left his life 2,000 miles away and made this journey to get there. And we are all fortunate, those of us who are peace-loving people, that that he did at some point, for whatever reason, make the decision to call 911 and essentially, you know, rat on himself so that the marshals were able to take him into custody peacefully, because the alternate was, you know, I've worked with the marshals a bunch of times in my career, and they are a premier federal law enforcement agency. And I can't imagine that there was any way he was going to get into that house. So that the consequences for him could have been dire. So everyone's fortunate that he chose to make that call.
Yeah. And the marshals didn't have to make a call to kill. I mean, he apparently told law enforcement that his plan was to kill himself. But I guess something snapped him out of it. And luckily those marshals then didn't have to carry that with them.
Correct.
22 years in the Secret Service for you, 5 years in presidential protection. Some people just think of the Secret Service as the people who protect the president, but it's a much larger mission than that, right? Can you talk about it a little?
Yeah. So the Secret Service was originally founded on April 14th, 1865, as part of the Treasury Department. And the only responsibility the Secret Service had at the time was the suppression of counterfeiting. When we came out of the Civil War, about a third of all the currency in circulation at the time was fake. President Lincoln decided, you know, he needed to do something to stem the tide because it was having a tremendously negative effect on the economy. So he created on April 14th, 1865, this small agency, just a handful of operatives. And the reason he called it the Secret Service was because in his mind's eye, he envisioned these operatives going undercover into these counterfeiting rings and breaking them up and putting the counterfeiters in jail. And they were incredibly successful at it. By the end of the 1860s, they had literally put thousands of counterfeiters in jail and really restored the public's trust in the currency that they carried. But a couple little twists of historic irony, one major twist of historic irony happened. April 14th, 1865, that morning, the president creates the Secret Service with no intention of there ever being presidential protection. And that night he went to Ford's Theater and he was assassinated. Then we jump ahead to 1881. Charles Guiteau kills President Garfield. And then in 1901, Leon Czolgosz killed President McKinley. And that's when Congress said, look, we need to find somebody to protect the presidents. So at that point, they handed the responsibility to the Secret Service. And that's a dual role that the Secret Service still has now. They still secure all Treasury obligations, but everyone knows them for the protection. We protected the president, vice president, and their families, former presidents, major presidential candidates, and any foreign head of state that comes to the United States. So whenever you see the Pope come or the Queen, you know, any foreign king, president, prime minister, folks like that who come to the United States, big and small, whether you've heard of them or not, they get Secret Service protection when they're here.
Jeff James, retired Secret Service agent. Good to talk to you, Jeff. Thanks.
Hey, pleasure's mine. Thank you.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
This is Jason Chaffetz with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Time's almost up for voters in Nevada, home to one of the races that could decide the balance of power in the U.S. Senate this November. Eight Republicans are on the ballot for Tuesday's Senate primary, hoping to take on incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto.
We have a chance to flip Nevada red again.
Former State Attorney General Adam Laxalt is considered the frontrunner, leading by double digits in recent polls, though some show that lead shrinking.
We've all learned that when the going gets tough, some Republicans just run for the hills.
In a campaign ad for Laxalt, former President Trump says there's no one more trustworthy in Nevada.
Adam Laxalt always puts America first and has my complete and total endorsement.
He was also part of a tele-rally for Laxalt this week, calling him a true warrior for conservative principles and the MAGA agenda. But Laxalt lost the governor's race in 2018, despite a family history of politics in the state. So his top primary challenger manager calls him a failed politician.
This primary, Nevada Republicans will choose if America is ruled by the elites or the people.
Sam Brown likes to emphasize a grassroots campaign and a much different background. He's a retired Army captain who suffered serious burns from an IED explosion in Afghanistan. He was a volunteer for the Trump campaign in 2020 and believes he's standing on the verge of victory, even if others don't.
You know, this race has always, felt like an underdog race, even before I had any opponent. I was the first one in it.
Brown is also a husband and father who grew up in Arkansas and says he chose to start a business and raise his family in Nevada.
You know, I was coming at this as, you know, someone who's just a member of the community. I'm a West Point grad, a combat vet, wounded, you know, a family man, kids in the local schools, a businessman. And so, you know, people in my community knew me, but it's not like, a whole state knew me or I had high name ID. So from the very beginning, this was an underdog race. But that's, you know, led me and the team that I've recruited and brought with me to, you know, work and earn every bit of support that we've got. And, you know, I think that running uphill actually makes you stronger. You don't take anything for granted, whether it's contributions from donors, time, commitment from volunteers, or even votes. And so we're hustling, and I think that's really proven to be beneficial and why we're, you know, knocking on the edge of a major upset victory, which public polling hasn't really covered because that data is now all about 1 month old. But our internal polling has shown that in that month, we've closed this thing down to a real close horse race.
What are people telling you on the campaign trail about their top concerns?
The economy is by far the top concern. And, you know, nationally, there's challenges, but there's also, you know, a hangover effect from COVID and the way that Steve Sisolak, our Democrat governor, handled COVID with, you know, very sort of top-down shutdown of our economy. And so that's number one issue. And then depending on where you go across the state, energy costs and water, because we've got major drought conditions here, water is also a major concern in education for many parents.
Why do you feel as though on these kinds of issues that you're better suited to hold this seat? What makes you the best candidate to tackle any of that? You're certainly a newcomer to politics, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the reasons that we've got this sort of festering issues that we have is because of the type of people who, you know, find their way into office are oftentimes, you know, almost sort of invited into that community. They owe a lot of people a lot of things, and so it drags out any sort of potential solutions into, you know, long years or even decades worth of, you know, wrangling. We need people who are problem solvers, solution oriented, you know, who come from outside of the system and only owe their constituents, the hard work that they deserve. I'm coming at this as someone who's, supported and funded and elected into office by Nevadans, not by some sort of, you know, party machine or, you know, endorsements, relying on endorsements from D.C. Political celebrities or anything like that. So I answer to the people, and I think when we have more folks like that sitting in the halls of Congress, we'll get more done on an expedited manner.
Former Nevada Attorney General Adam Laxalt, though, does have the backing of some Republican heavyweights, including former President Trump. Does that come up as you've been out campaigning? Does that seem to matter to people, either in a positive or negative way?
It does. I'd say that, there are some people, not as many as you would expect, but there are some people who, you know, want to honor President Trump's endorsement. That's the only thing that matters to them. But the vast majority of folks will tell me, Sam, President Trump made a mistake, and he doesn't know Nevada, and he doesn't know how Adam Laxalt has failed us in the past. And, you know, they looked to when he was attorney general, how he mismanaged, you know, even the election integrity issues. When the Secretary of State's office reported that illegal immigrants were registering to vote through the DMV, he didn't do anything about it as attorney general. And then he lost the race in 2018 for the governor. And, you know, a lot of folks look at him and he had all the tailwind in the world, you know, the same sort of endorsements, the same access to money, you know. And I think at the end of the day, that can create a lazy candidate who's more responsive to D.C. and their donors than to the people who are electing them. And he burned Nevada voters. And in fact, he blamed 100,000 Trump voters in 2018 when he lost the governor's race. He said 100,000 Trump voters didn't come out for me. And people remember that.
What about the fact that you're not originally from Nevada? I know it's fodder in some campaign ads, but is that a criticism that's resonating with people?
No. You know, there may be someone who's, you know, just dead set on voting for Laxalt and they want to bring that up. But over 80% of Nevadans aren't from here. This is an extremely transient state. It leads the nation in terms of, you know, people who've moved here from elsewhere. It's not a good critique. And in fact, I think most people look at that as a sign of desperation from a campaign that has every advantage in the world and is on the verge of losing. So it actually really displays a lot of weakness in the Laxalt camp. But look, we're all Americans, and I think that's one of the things we got to get back to is we're all Americans. And, you know, when I put on the uniform and serve this country, I wasn't just serving Arkansans where I was born. I wasn't just serving Texas where I was deployed from. I was serving Nevadans and all Americans as well.
You've actually been outspending Laxalt. There are outside groups, PACs, that'll try to close that gap, and it can turn very negative. Are you concerned going forward about being able to get your message out to voters?
No. We've got the sort of grassroots funding that we need to be able to get our message out on TV and radio ads and online that we feel like is effective. In fact, if you would have told me a year ago that we'd be where we're at financially, I'd say that, you know, I would have thought that was just amazing. And it is amazing. And it's an amazing testament to the over 40,000 people who have donated to this campaign. I mean, the average donation to our campaign is $63. And so this is what a movement of the people looks like. This is how you earn trust. And this is how you stay responsive to the people who are electing you.
If you did win the primary, what would be your strategy to take on Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in the fall? She won by just over 2 points in 2016, which was the same margin from President Biden in Nevada. But, you know, how flippable is this Senate seat, in your opinion, and how would you win it in the fall?
Yeah, you know, Cortez Masto is going to have to answer for how she stewarded her tenure as a senator. And unfortunately for Nevadans and unfortunately for Cortez Masto in the end, she did not manage her time well. She was not a champion for Nevada. And, you know, she has voted in lockstep with, you know, Biden and his, you know, year and a half in office. And those policies have hurt Nevadans and they've hurt Americans. And so, you know, we'll stay very focused on policies and holding her accountable for her action where appropriate and her inaction where appropriate.
Sam Brown, retired U.S. Army captain, Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in Nevada. Lots of luck with the campaign.
Thank you so much.
Fox
News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
A military veteran in Florida is making headlines for his gift to another veteran who suffered a major setback after a crime. George Giraldo is an Army veteran and welder whose tools were stolen when his truck was recently broken into. Nearly $10,000 worth of equipment, including torches and other items, was taken. WSVN News aired the story about the theft, and Bill Coleman was watching. Coleman is also a veteran and a retired merchant marine. He says he felt compelled to do something. So he donated the tools Giraldo needed in order to get back to work. Giraldo told WSVN he's got a new lifelong friend and that veterans stick together, saying of Coleman, quote, "We're brothers forever, man. God bless you." Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jason Chaffetz.
What's on your mind?
Surprise! The Biden Justice Department, led by Attorney General Merrick Garland, will not be prosecuting lawbreakers within its ranks. The Inspector General for the Department of Justice released its semi-annual report to Congress of cases for which the IG recommends prosecutions. But in case after case, the Department of Justice is declining to prosecute its own. The one notable exception is Bureau of Prisons personnel, who still have reason to fear repercussions if they break the law. But if you're in the FBI or DEA, you can be virtually assured you will not be prosecuted based on the long list of cases DOJ has declined to prosecute. Apparently, if you work for the right agency, anything goes. Just how serious are the allegations of lawbreaking? Here are a few examples from Inspector General Michael Horowitz's report. Sexual solicitation. Quote, while working for the FBI overseas, multiple then FBI officials solicited, engaged in, and or procured commercial sex. It was also alleged that one of the FBI officials provided another official a package containing approximately 100 white pills to deliver to a foreign law enforcement officer. The investigation was presented for prosecution on August 17, 2018, and declined on January 17, 2020. Fraud, quote, after receiving information from the FBI alleging that then supervisory special agent may have committed time and attendance fraud during a six-month period, the investigation was presented for prosecution on June 27, 2018, and declined on March 15, 2021. Conflicts of interest, quote, a then senior official with the DEA gave preferential treatment to a particular pharmaceutical company by prioritizing the company's requests for drug quota increases over other pending requests. The allegation further stated that the pharmaceutical company's request to the DEA had been made by a former DEA official then employed by the pharmaceutical company. The investigation was presented for prosecution on June 16, 2015, and declined on August 26, 2021. Given the lack of accountability within federal law enforcement, it's no wonder federal agents are willing to misuse their authority. This may also help explain why DOJ has a deepening problem with public perception and low morale. There are many committed professionals at the 110,000-person agency, but when those who cut corners are allowed to thrive and suffer no consequences, it sends a message. The corruption grows. DOJ officials should be held to a higher standard. We might even settle for just holding them to the same standard as the rest of us. But this unwillingness to hold their own accountable undermines faith in federal law enforcement and signals a tolerance for misbehavior. 6 months from now, we will read about a similar report. Something needs to change. But clearly, President Biden and his Democrat majorities have little interest in reining in federal law enforcement. I'm Jason Chaffetz, Fox News contributor and host of the Jason in the House podcast on the Fox News Radio Network.
You've been listening- listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.